I want to say a few things about it. And we're going to start with this morning. The cover is simply a description of a designation of our meetings and some information about the two speakers that will be here. And then the booklet is made up of 7 pages of terms that are relative to some of the subject matter that will be discussed, particularly on the Saturday seminar. Now, before you open it, let me say this. We take the responsibility and put the effort into publishing this in hopes that you will study this, go home and read it. Some of you have been exposed to uniformitarian concepts of geology and biological evolution in a sort of a technical way. We even have some people here who majored in geology on the undergraduate level. And they will be familiar with some of this. There'll be some other terms in here from a creationist point of view that perhaps they haven't had. But for most of you, you haven't been exposed to it. So you come on the Saturday to the seminars and you look very interested, etc. And you go away and you say, well, that was real good and everything. But you really didn't learn too much because you thought you weren't smart enough and it went over your head. You were glad that men of Dr. Morris's caliber biblicists, etc. and so on, and that made you happy and you got a good sort of sensation on it, but you really didn't learn too much. Now let me assure you that just by a little bit of study, particularly in terms of terminology and words and what they mean, you'll find that seminar will be 10 times as meaningful to you. It'll begin to take on meaning. You can even come to the place where you can talk intelligently to people about this. And of course, the purpose of this whole 3 months that we're starting, we only have 3 more weeks after today. The purpose of all this is sort of to prepare you for this thing and so that you'll approach it sort of in an intelligent way. So I hope you'll take this glossary of terms and go over it, read it, read through it, and become somewhat acquainted with some of the terminology. This morning I want to turn to the last term in the book, the word uniformitarianism. Okay, now what we have to do this morning is to get some type of an idea of the model of life and life history as seen from the biological evolutionist and the geological uniformitarianist, the way that he sees life emerging. And we'll try to contrast that very simply with what the Bible has to say about the way life emerged. But you cannot appreciate the great debate that is going on over this issue unless you understand what the uniformitarian geologist and the biological evolutionist is saying. So this morning we're going to try to at least give you a general concept of what that model is like. To do that, we'll start with a definition of the term uniformitarianism. It's on the last page of this glossary of terms. By the way, is there enough to go around? Everybody have one? Anybody need one? There are plenty out on the table. We can just send somebody out to get them. Anybody need one? Okay. Uniformitarianism, last statement on page 7. The doctrine that all geological phenomena may be explained as resulting from presently observable processes that have always and will always operate in the same way. In other words, uniformitarianism is a term relative to the way things are formed in the surface of the earth. I put that in my own terms, definition of something like this. Uniformitarianism is the concept that all things that are being formed in the surface of the earth, like coal, like oil, like rock, all things that are now being formed in the surface of the earth have been formed in the past as they are now being formed, and they will always be formed as they are now being formed. Consequently, if it takes millions and millions of years for a coal tar product, first you have to have the proper organic material buried under a certain amount of debris and pressure, and then you have to have a time for those organic matters to decay in a certain fashion so the coal tar product is formed, and that takes millions of years. Uniformitarianism is the concept that this has always been the way that coal tar products have been formed, etc., etc., etc. There is such a thing as the rain falling on the earth, and then you have erosion, and then you have sedimentation building up, etc., and so on, and this is the way things are formed in the surface of the earth. Another definition would read this way. Uniformitarianism is the view that existing causes acting in the same manner and with essentially the same intensity as at present are sufficient to account for all the geological changes both in the present and in the past. So a priori, in other words, a basic assumption or presupposition maybe, a basic presupposition of uniformitarianism is that the present is the key to the past in terms of geological phenomena. Now, biological evolution takes that same concept and applies it to life forms. The Earth crust, viewed in this way, then becomes a historical time clock. And if you drill down through the Earth crust, then you will be drilling through the pine ages. And as you go deeper and deeper, you go back millions and millions and millions of years. Okay? This is the concept of uniformitarianism. Now, in contrast to that, is the concept of catastrophism. We return to page 2 of this philosophy. Catastrophism. Okay. Catastrophism is the doctrine that the Earth's crust has been suddenly changed by physical force, by violent physical force. And the word sudden is a very important word. It happened not over a period of a long period of time, but very, very suddenly. Now, catastrophism is a term that clashes with uniformitarianism. Uniformitarianism says, no, there hasn't been any violent disasters that have affected, in general, the surface of the earth. Now, there may have been a Denver flood in 1965, and that affected the Denver area slightly, but it was just local. See? There's nothing to be influential in a universal sense in terms of affecting the geological processes. So, uniformitarianism rejects catastrophism in its general sense. Okay, now listen for just a second. That was not true until about 1830. Until 1830, catastrophism was the norm of the explanation of geological processes. It wasn't until the writings of Charles Lyell that catastrophism was rejected. Now, uniformitarianism has become the norm of the geological, academic, intellectual world. So that if you are a catastrophist now, then you are all ostracized from the intellectual world. And probably the greatest illustration of this is Emil Velikovsky, who in the late 40s and early 50s wrote some books propagating catastrophic influences upon the surface of the earth, and he was immediately ostracized from the academic community. He couldn't get a job at Harvard. He couldn't get his books published and his materials published. But now, his scientific propositions have had such an influence that he has been accepted in the intellectual world, and he has swayed many people to catastrophism. I have a statement here from Newsweek in 1963. Yeah. Maybe I don't have it here. Yes, I do. And it is like this, quote, "It was the major line of thought for a few decades, the last century, that was catastrophism was a major line of thought. But a vigorous counterattack by the naturalist, meaning the uniformitarian geologist, eventually pushed it aside. But not many geologists believe the counterattack may have been too vigorous. In their haste to reject the hand of God, they passed over some solid evidence that could help improve their understanding of both geology and evolution. As a result, many geologists at a recent meeting of the American Geological Society were advising the rehabilitation of catastrophism." This is in 1963. But listen to the last part of the sentence. "Without recourse to a supernatural agent." Even Emmanuel Velikovsky, Emmanuel Velikovsky is an agnostic, he's an atheist. He doesn't claim to believe the Bible in no way. But he does believe in catastrophic influences on the surface of the earth. And even with that simple belief, he was ostracized from the academic community. There are now some writing by the scientific mafia. They had him booted out. Okay. Okay. So now I've got to be more detailed. We've got to go into more detail to give you a picture. So I have printed up a typical geological timetable. Now I think we have enough for everybody here. If you're not sitting beside your wife, take one. But if you are sitting beside your wife, then share the same one. And some of these you can't see too well. If you're sitting beside your sister, you can take one because nobody wants to look on the same page as your sister. I think there is enough of these for everyone. Okay, this is a typical geological timetable. It is how a geologist in college, one of the first courses he would have would be a course in geological history. That kind of grates on a historian's nerves that they would call it history because they don't have any definitive sources that they can define it as history, yet they call it that. But this is one of the first courses you would take if you went to school of Mines, for instance. Okay. Now, there's a lot of material on that page, and you will, you know, it can overwhelm you, but I'm going to go through it and point out some of the significant aspects of this page, and you can take it home with you if you want to and look it out, look it over. On the left-hand side of the page, we have the five major eras of geological time. Now, those eras are named for the fossils that are found in them. There are five of them. Archaeozoic, I'm starting at the bottom of the page. Archaeozoic, Proterozoic, Paleozoic, Mesozoic, and Cenozoic. That's Cenozoic, the top one. It didn't spell too well. Everybody with me? Your left-hand side of your page. There are five major eras. Now, if you look in the third column, your note how these are dated. The Archaeozoic age is 1 billion to 1 billion 800 million years old. The Proterozoic is 500 million to 1 billion years old. Now, that's beyond that. We can't imagine how much time that is. I mean, I can't even give you an illustration of how much time it is. If you sit, it would never impress you how much time it is. Even in dollars, you can't imagine. Nobody here can. The Paleozoic is 200,000 to 500 million, or 200 million to 500 million years old. The Mesozoic is 70 million to 200 million. And that's the age, and you'll notice that at the beginning of that age, over on the right-hand column, which is characteristic life, you have earliest dinosaurs to the extinction of the dinosaurs. The dinosaurs, in other words, are supposed to have lived in the Mesozoic period, 200 million to 70 million years. Then you have the Cenozoic era, which runs from 75 million down to 25,000 years ago. Okay. Now, if you wanted to, over where it says characteristic life, on your sheet, top of the right-hand column, characteristic life, you would have the, this is the same as the index of fossils. Index of fossils, or the fossil index. And what that is, in essence, is the evolutionary uniformitarian model of life. How life emerged. Now, what I'm going to do on Roverhead is to simplify that and give you sort of the main ideas. And while I'm doing it, I'll show you how that these ears are named for the fossils that are found in them. In other words, the word Archaeozoic, Protozoic, Paleozoic, and so on are biological terms and relative to the life forms that are supposed to be of that era. Okay. So what we have then, essentially, I have a diagram here of the origin of life from the evolutionary and uniformitarian concepts. Evolution and uniformitarian life model. Or life structure. And this is how they characterize the emergence of life. First of all, we have the Archaeozoic Age. Archaeozoic Age. Okay, that is on the bottom of your page on the left-hand side. The word Archaeozoic, Archaeo, Arch means first in Greek. So these are Greek terms. So this then would be first, Archaeo, or beginning. And Zoic is from Zoe, which means life. The first or beginning life. The Archaeozoic Age, which is about 1 to 2 billion years ago, right? Okay, now the interesting thing is that there aren't any fossils for the Archaeozoic Age. So in other words, if you are following the concept of evolutionary uniformitarian geology, you start off with 1 to 2 billion years without anything. And what you would have is sort of ocean water. Ocean water. Okay. You move to the next stage, and you're going up the ladder now, the evolutionary ladder, and you go to the Protozoa, or Protozoic Age. Protozoic Age. Okay. Protozoa comes from protos, which means first. First life. First life. And we now are in the age of 500 million to 1 billion years ago. Okay, now primarily in the Protozoic can mean first or before. Before the kind of life forms that we now know. And unfortunately, I think it's unfortunate for this concept that there are no Brownian index fossils for this period either, so you lose another 500 million years. But the concept is that there were primitive water-dwelling plants and animals. So you move from ocean water to primitive water-dwelling plants. Now if you put down an animal, somebody's going to say, what animals? And there's no answer. Somehow these animals emerge from the plants. It depends on whom you're reading as to where the first source of life came. But anyhow, you had to have, first of all, back here, inorganic matter. Then in here you have organic matter. Now you move from organic matter to life form. Okay, so to the next stage then. See, this then would be ocean water, and this would be protozoa. Protozoa, or protozoa. First life form, or before life form. Now from there, you have to move in the evolutionary pattern to invertebrates. Invertebrates. And in the geological, biological scheme of life form, the invertebrates come in the Paleozoic age. So over here on the left, we move up the ladder to the Paleozoic age. Paleozoic. Now, paleo simply means ancient. Ancient life. Okay, so we've had, in a few years, we very rapidly cut, well, two covered, and we're on the Paleozoic, the third. Now, simply put, you move from invertebrates to vertebrates. Now, what are the first vertebrates in the uniformitarian scheme of things? What were they? What kind of life forms? Okay, so we learned something. Fish. Fish. Now, a fish is a vertebrate. What's a vertebrate? You better get back and start all over again. What's a vertebrate? It has a backbone. Okay, it has a backbone. So you move from an invertebrate, doesn't have a backbone, to a vertebrate. Okay. Now, on your sheet, if you want to look at the sheet, well, let's get one more important aspect of the vertebrates. You move from the vertebrates to amphibians. The amphibians in this period. All of this occurs in the Paleozoic age. So in other words, three of the great developments of life forms in the Paleozoic age would be invertebrates, the emergence of invertebrates, then the emergence of vertebrates, and then the emergence of amphibians. What's an amphibian? Can live on land or water, it can come in or out of water. Okay. Okay, now that took, according to the uniformitarian scheme of things, 200 million to 500 million years. Okay, now we do have some fossil records. And if you notice on your sheet, the center column has to do with the period. You divide the Paleozoic age up into about seven or eight periods, the oldest of which is the Cambrian period. It is in Cambrian rocks that the first invertebrates are found. Brachiopods and trilobites. Highly developed, and very suddenly, within the rock strata, you find an emergence of complex life forms, corals, sponges, and this type of thing. In other words, what the geological timetable purports as history, to me at least, defeats itself. Because what they're saying is that you have, from the simple life form to the complex life form, that all life emerged from a one-celled form of life. And as you move up the evolutionary tree, see, the evolutionary tree has only one root, and there's only one tree in the life form. And as you move up, you start off with the one-celled animal, and as you move up the tree, then life becomes more and more complex. But all of a sudden, in the uniform Unitarian scheme of things, you actually have some pretty complex invertebrates to appear all at once on the scene. And there's nothing to precede them, as far as we know. Okay. Instead of that proving your point, since you defeated, this is more biblical, because the Bible does not start off with a single tree. It starts off with very complex life forms. Okay. All at once. And that's actually what you find in the rock strata. Now, the Corinthians of the Institute for Creation Research has written a little book called Evolution, Explanation Point, The Fossils Say No. And this is what he lectured on when he was here last April. He showed us how the fossils did not prove evolution, they proved just the opposite. See, it depends on who's interpreting the data again. It's this problem of interpretation. Okay, all of a sudden then, in the Cambrian rock strata, we have the emergence of some pretty complex life forms, and when we move up to more complex life forms, vertebrates and amphibians. Okay. So on your sheet, you see we're moving from the bottom to the top. We're moving up the timetable. The next stage was the Mesozoic age. Mesozoic. These terms are here. Meso means in between or intermediate. Intermediate. In between. Intermediate life form is the idea. Okay. Now, this is beautiful. In the Mesozoic age, you have probably one of the most interesting things to offer, the dinosaurs. If you aren't on your feet, if you look in the right-hand column, characteristic life, in the Triassic age, or the Triassic period of the Mesozoic age, you have the earliest dinosaurs, flying reptiles, marine reptiles, and primitive mammals. Now, at the top, as you approach the end of this age, which lasts from approximately 200 million to 70 million years ago, 200 million to 70 million. As you approach the 70 million period, going up the right-hand column, you have modern angiosperms and insects abundant. You have flying mammals profuse. You have the extinction of dinosaurs, flying reptiles, and animals. In other words, according to the geological timetable, the extinction of dinosaurs comes in the Cretaceous rock layer. And that occurs 70 million years ago. Now if you look at the top of the page, sometime about 25,000 years ago, you had the rise of modern plants and animals and man. So according to the geological timetable, you have the extinction of the dinosaur 70 million years ago, and you have the emergence of man 25,000 years ago. Now that is the emergence of man. Dinosaurs extinct. So see, you've been reading BC all these years, and it's not even true. There weren't any men around. Except there is some fossil evidence of men being around when dinosaurs were around. There are footprints, for example. In the Pulaski Riverbed near Glen Rose, Texas, of dinosaur tracks and human tracks in the same rock strata. And the last time, in 1970, we had clock here with plaster of Paris mold of those footprints. He carried them on the airplane with him. Had to hold them in his lap when he was flying up here to show them to us. So if you have human footprints in the same rock strata and in the same place, I mean, it isn't as though they got the footprint of the man in Texas, and they said, this is a man's footprint in a Cretaceous rock strata, and they went over to India and got a footprint of a dinosaur, and they said, this is a footprint of a dinosaur in a Cretaceous rock layer. They didn't do that. They're right in the same riverbed, together. Which indicates pretty dramatically that there were human brains on the scene when there were dinosaurs. Yeah. Okay. But anyhow, I shouldn't be pointing out too much the disparagement of this. I'm just trying to communicate to you what this really is there. So the Mesozoic then is the emergence of an intermediate life form, 70 million years to 200. Million years ago. So you have in that period over here, then you have reptiles, and if that doesn't help you, then you put the word dinosaurs down. You can learn how to spell dinosaurs. You can learn how, I just abbreviate. Okay. Now the last period is known as the Cenozoic era. Cenozoic. Ceno means recent life form. Okay, according to the evolutionary chart and the pattern and the model, recent life forms have only emerged in the last 70 million years. And man, in that spectrum, doesn't appear until 25,000 years ago. Okay, now here is one that's a real, real beauty. Somehow, out of the reptiles, you have to have a division. So in the right-hand column on this simplified chart that I'm giving you, you have the word reptile. Now, out of those reptiles, there has to come two things. One, there has to come fowl life, and there has to come mammals. And they have to emerge slowly. Somehow, this reptile that is walking around on land mass has to decide that he wants to fly. And somehow, he has got to develop the equipment to fly. Now, he has to develop the equipment to fly over an extremely long period of time. And he has to survive while he's doing it, so that he's not destroyed by the other mammals that are on the scene. So somehow he has to develop wings, hollow bones, and learn to fly, and over a long period of time, and yet not be destroyed by other animals that are capable of destroying him. Now, if you explain that one to me, and this might take on some meaning to me, but I don't think that's explainable. Much easier for me to believe that God created fowl life, the necessary fowl life, to produce all the fowl life that there exists in the world today. Much more easy. Because you have to realize that there were reptiles on the scene that were carnivorous. And remember, in your scheme of things, it's survival of the fittest. Well, a little old bird that's trying to develop a wing that isn't even developed yet, he's not very fit. All he's got a little beak to peck at. These other things have teeth and tails and claws and et cetera. But this is the concept, not only that, but mammals developed out of the That's tough. First of all, you had to have the mammals come ashore, then you have to have a whale come out of there. Once he gets on shore, then he wants to go back to the water, so he goes back to the water, and then he stays in the water like a whale, and he gives birth to live offspring in the water. A whale is a mammal. Very, very difficult to accept for my family reference, but nevertheless, this is what this teaches. So in this next period, the Eye of the Reptiles, up in here, you have first of all the emergence of fowl and mammals, both land mammals and sea mammals, and so on. Okay, now out of the mammals then will come man. He doesn't come out of the fowl life. Maybe that's why we can't fly. Okay. So all of this is within the last 100,000 years. You'll notice there's one thing I want to point out in the top period on your sheet. In the second column, in the period, will you please note the second period, the Pleistocene epoch. 970,000 years ago in the Cross of Minnesotan was a key event to all geologists. The Pleistocene epoch is the Ice Age. Now that's critical to the end. Now the Ice Age would be a catastrophe, wouldn't it? And it would be almost universal in its scope, but not quite. Not all the way, but almost universal. So the uniformitarian does accept one almost potential universal catastrophe, the Ice Age. He has to. But he cannot decide how many Ice Ages there are. So depending on who's writing and who's teaching, you'll be taught that there was one Ice Age in a university up to X number of Ice Ages. Maybe 10, maybe 20, maybe 4, etc. They cannot decide how many there were. Okay, are there any questions about, in general, about that piece? Yeah. Question, yes. Just go one to the other. And this is what Bush points out so beautifully in his book. His concept is that you would anticipate intermediary forms. Certainly you would. If there's this evolutionary process, then there has to be intermediary forms. You never find them. You just go from one to the other. And he does a beautiful job in this little book. Okay, another question. They don't believe in the noise plate. They don't believe in it. The only universal flood that they believe in is, and I don't know if you'd say that would be a flood, but they believe that life began back in the beginning in ocean water. Now, how universal those ocean waters were, and whether they would say that the whole world was covered by water at that time, I don't know. They localize it. But see, there are theologians that localize it too, like Bernard Williams, who wrote the book Science and the Scriptures, which is nothing more, nothing less than theistic evolution. So, No, they existed before the flood. I think we have to assume that. But they couldn't. No, not necessarily. Not necessarily. Not necessarily animal life. But after the flood, we assume that the environment was so changed that they could not exist. I'm going to show you. that the flood presents the best explanation of the ice age and also of the trapping of the woolly mammoth in the Siberian ice cap. I bet. There were some species put on the ice, but there were some that, of course, there were only two. The other ones didn't get on. Yeah, they didn't survive. You know, everybody knows about the woolly mammoths, don't you? And in the Siberian ice cap, that there are hundreds and hundreds of woolly mammoths preserved in ice. Some of them with buttercups in their mouths. Still there, preserved. They thawed some. Perfectly preserved. That meant that there were buttercups in that region and that they could live in that region. Now, there's nothing like that there today. There's tundra there, but nothing like these mammals have had in their mouth. And that's one of the complex problems of geological history, how to explain those. Well, a flood presents a good potential explanation for this. How did you explain? Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. Okay. Yeah, it explains that the ice age. No, and it's not sudden enough. See, because what would a woolly mammoth do when the ice started coming slowly? He'd start heading south. But these were trapped. I don't know. I really don't know. I'm not posing as an expert on uniform decaying geology. Yes. They don't believe that man existed in the ice age. I don't believe that man existed as he now is in the ice age. See, the ice age happened almost. Now, the same thing talking about the ice age. Again, like I say, I'm talking in general now. I'm talking about the general scheme of things. And in the evolutionary cycle, in the evolutionary theory, and even in the geological theory, you sometimes have to say, this man says this, and this man says that. But I'm not talking about general. They do not believe in general that man existed in the ice age. Well, animal life existed, but it moved towards warmer climate. No, because the ice age was not universal. Although it was almost, and it was catastrophic. But it wasn't universally catastrophic. You would move to warmer climates, and hence life forms as we know it in history would emerge then in the warmer places, like the Mesopotamia Valley and the Nubian Valley. In Africa. Well, some of that too could be post-Noahic flood from our point of view. Because dinosaurs did exist after the flood. But they didn't come to have existed very long. Well, I'm going to take the whole time on that. I'll take the whole session on the Paleolithic men. I'll take the whole session on that. They would be dated within the, if you want to put it in your sheet there, it would be in this quaternary, the top one. They would all be in there. They would all be in that top one. Okay. Question. Yeah, some sea life would survive. Some sea life would maybe, because of the horrendous upheaval, would destroy an awful lot of sea life, but not all sea life. I don't think they could exist in the type of ecology that we now have, but there could be some remnants of them, maybe. I want to give you, in contrast to this, and I haven't gotten to the subject that I wanted to get to, but I'm saying we've got to understand this before we say anything else. I'm gonna go ahead and do what I was gonna do. I want to give you 8 geological implications of the flood. 8 geological implications of the biblical account of the flood. The basic presupposition of Moses' great apology, the Genesis flood, the basic presupposition of this book is that if there was a flood of the proportion that is portrayed in the Bible, it would be so destructive to uniformitarianism that you would have to say uniformitarianism only from the flood. It would be so destructive to the earth's crust, a flood of the proportion that the Bible portrayed would be so destructive to the earth's crust that you could only date uniformitarian processes since the flood. Okay, so he gives, in his book, from pages 120 to 124, 8 geological implications of the biblical account of the flood. This is Henry Morris, pages 120 to 124, the Genesis flood. The first one would be, very obvious, tremendous erosion from the rainfall. Tremendous erosion from the rainfall. The implication to the Bible account is that that rainfall was universal, not local. I'm reading now from page 120. Great quantities of water were poured down on the earth from the skies, not in the form of gentle drizzle, but as a torrential downpour, continuing without ceasing for 40 days and 40 nights all over the world. Speaking metaphorically, the scriptures say that, quote, the floodgates of heaven were open, end of quote. This pounding rain would first, by its own impact, begin the work of soil and rock erosion. It so happens that Henry Morris's major field in his PhD work is the action of water upon the surface of the earth. Modern hydrology has proved that raindrop impact is a very significant factor on the initiation of erosion phenomena. As the waters begin to run off the lower levels, already containing a certain amount of sedimentary load to aid in further erosive action by the mechanism of turbulus and attrition, it would begin to form rivulets. These would run finally to the nearest stream, but in the process would deepen the stream's channels by further erosion. This is the way in which great gullies are formed, often to great depths in one single rainstorm in present day. For the uniquely intense rainstorm of the deluge, the combined processes of raindrop impact, sea erosion, and gully erosion would necessarily have excavated and transported prodigious quantities of earth and rock, even if no other agencies had been available for sediment transfer. Second, geological implications. Our present atmosphere was not, now I've already told you some of these, was not the source of the flood waters, or of all the flood waters. Okay. A global rain continuing for 40 days, as described in the Bible, would have required a completely different mechanism for its production than is available today. If all the water in our present atmosphere was suddenly precipitated all at one time, it would only suffice to cover the ground to an average of less than 2 inches. process of their operation could not have been effective during the rain, of course, since the atmosphere immediately above the Earth was already at a saturation level. But the normal hydrological cycle would, therefore, have been incapable of supplying the tremendous amounts of rain the Bible records describe. In other words, uniform occurring processes of rain today could not have provided the type of water that was needed for the flood. Okay. The implication seems to be that the antediluvian climatology and meteorology were much different than the present. There seems to have been an atmospheric source of water of an entirely type, different type and earlier than the magnitude that now exists. The third geological implication would be enlarged ocean beds. This would be the fountains of the deep breaking up. Enlarged ocean beds and the elevation of the continent. And that there would be profound, unparalleled geological change, such as the world has never experienced before nor since. Whatever the source of the deluge rain, the masses of water which descended to the earth could hardly have been elevated back to the heavens, because it is not there now. This can only mean that much of the water of our present oceans entered the oceans at the time of the flood. This in turn implies that the proportion of land area to the water area was much larger before the flood, perhaps very much water larger than at present. Much of the present sea bottom was once dry land. Very likely, in order to accommodate the great mass of waters and to permit the land to appear again, great tectonic movements and isotopic adjustments would have to take place, forming the deep ocean basins and the troughs and elevating the continents. This seems to be what is specifically stated in Psalm 104, verses 5 to 9, which we've already looked at, when we talk about the orogeny during the middle of the flood. Okay, the fourth geological implication of the biblical record of the flood is volcanic and seismic upheavals. Volcanic and seismic upheaval. Great volcanic explosions and eruptions are clearly implied in the statement, quote, all the fountains of the deep were broken up. This must mean that great quantities of liquids, perhaps liquid rocks or magma, as well as water, probably steam, had been confined under great pressure below the rock structure of the earth since the time of its formation, and that this mass now burst forth through great fountains, probably both on the land and under the sea. By analogy with present phenomena associated with volcanism, volcano emergence and so on, there must also have been great earthquakes and tsunamis, properly known as tidal waves, generated throughout the world. These eruptions and waves would have augmented the floodwaters as well as accomplished great amounts of geological work directly. The fifth implication was the unprecedented sedimentary activity. Now, sedimentary activity is simply the depositing of sediment. If you are from Wyoming or have been in Wyoming or fish in the any of the man-made lakes on the Platte system, and those man-made lakes, which were made back in the 30s, are the basis for the production of the Platte River Valley in Nebraska. These people could never have lived up there without those lakes, because that's where they get the irrigation water. But one of the great problems of those lakes are sediment. They just, at the first, those things fill up for miles. A real fine sediment, the deposit of sedimentary layers. Okay, now that's what Mr. Morris is saying, that the flood would be very conducive to unprecedented sedimentary activity, such as the world has never seen. The entire account plainly yields the inference that tremendous quantities of earth and rock must have been excavated by the water, Many factors contributed. There's driving rain, the raging streams, the earthquakes, volcanic upheavals, powerful tidal waves, and later waves and other currents generated by the rising of the lands and the sinking of the basin, and perhaps many other factors which we can't even guess. Never since the world was formed could there have been such extensive erosion of soil and rock beds on a global scale as during the Genesis flood. All the materials that were eroded must eventually have been redeposited somewhere else, and necessarily in stratified layers, like you see when you go to the Grand Canyon. Perfect illustration of stratified sedimentary layers of varying color. Six. The flood, the biblical account, presents ideal conditions for the formation of fossils. If the flood fulfilled divine purpose, all of land animals and plants were trapped and eventually buried in moving masses of sediment, which in turn would be very conducive to fossilization. Never was there such an ideal condition in history as far as we know. And so antediluvian flora and fauna seems to have been richer and more varied than in our present world. This is inferred in our deduction that the land areas were much more extensive than the present, and were also from the implication that the pre-diluvian climate was vastly different. Suffice to note at present that with the primary purpose of the deluge to destroy all life on the earth, at least on dry land, except the ark passengers, there must have been uncommon multitudes of living creatures as well as plants, crops, and eventually buried in the moving masses of sediment. Okay. Now, Morris's solution to this concept of the various forms of life that we do have in the rock strata is that this process would have settled these things out in this fashion. The surging and the receding and the surging and the receding. It's just like when you're panning for gold. What happens? You're shaking it around. What happens to the gold? It settles out, sort of a placer effect, yeah. Sorting is the word, yes. The sorting of the water. That's the word, sorting. Okay, point seven. The entire concept of utilitarianism is undermined by the Noah's flood. Now there is a partial answer to Mr. Bird's question. All the flood traditions around the world and so on, they make all those local. Because a concept of a universal flood, and they know this, is so destructive to uniformitarianism that, and they are so enamored with uniformitarianism, despite the works of Emanuel Velikovsky. Despite that Emanuel Velikovsky in the last 20 years has now begun to emerge to his rightful place in the academic world, even though he's not a believer and he's even an atheist, he doesn't attribute catastrophism to God. He attributes catastrophism to some unnatural happening in the universe. Maybe Venus approached the Earth and orbited the Earth and so on. He'll have some human explanation. Never resorts to God. Despite all of that, catastrophism, and there could never have been a Noah's flood because it destroys uniformitarianism. They know that, see? Okay. All right, the eighth point. The eighth, he doesn't give this one in his book. I'll pick it up from, he does give it in his book, but later on, he doesn't give it in this, these pages. This would be pages 288 to 299, and this is the one I wanted to show you, but I won't have time. Let me go put it down quick. The Noahic flood, offers a viable solution for the problem of the ice age. Now let's use the proper term, the Pleistocene age, because these men that are coming are academic men, and they used to teach them in college. Dr. Morris taught for 20 years. He was the head of the civil engineering department at Virginia Polytech. Last year, he was still teaching in the University of Texas. They used to talk in academic terms, which means that about three kids out of the class get it, and the rest don't, but the teacher doesn't care. The Noahic flood offers a viable solution for the problem of the ice age. And I don't have time to read from the book, but you can maybe look at those pages. Okay. So in other words, what Morris is saying is that if there was a flood of the proportions that the Bible says there was, and he believes that there was that kind of flood, then it destroys the whole concept of uniformitarianism, except as uniformitarianism is a reality since the flood. And that would only be in the last 7,000 and at the most 10,000 years. Right? Okay, now the next thing we meet, we'll be talking about the biblical pattern, or the biblical model. What does the Bible say about life? See, some people are saying nowadays, well, evolution and the Bible aren't that far apart. In fact, they're in basic agreement. And they'll show you how there was water and life came out of water and so on. Well, we've got to show you that's not true. If you believe what the Bible says, you cannot believe that. I want to show you why. It's superficial, that approach. Very, very superficial. And we're going to see why. Okay? So we pray. Father, we thank you for this time and this opportunity for learning experience. We thank you that we can learn negative aspects of that are around us and are vying for the minds of our children and our college-age people.